Just like the Massey prenup, today's episode of Accept the Mystery, where Jackie, Jake, Fleischer, and I discuss the Coens' legal farce, Intolerable Cruelty, is ironclad and impenetrable. In fact, they teach a whole semester on it at Harvard Law. JFIO presents.
What? Are you kidding? We got us a family here.
This ain't no coon, huh?
Okay, I'm not gonna sit here and debate.
I'll show you the life of a blind!
You will find a fortune. It would not be the fortune you seek.
I suppose you think you've raised hell.
When I've raised hell, you'll know it.
Something is very wrong. I don't want Santana Abraxas. I've just been in a terrible auto accident.
What's the most you ever lost in the coin toss?
Sometimes knowledge is yours.
Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast.
Welcome back to Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast, where we dissect. What is that's not a word. That sounds gross. Dissect. Where we dissect every single Coen Brothers movie in absurd, ridiculous, grotesque, excruciating levels of detail. My name is Josh Richmond. Sitting across from me is my co-host, Jackie Lechtholtz-Zay.
Hello.
It feels like it's been a while since we've been in this space recording
a podcast. This is like the best. This is a reunion.
I know, because we had a couple weeks we had to take off, and podcast we recorded at Matt Gorley's ridiculous room with all the instruments in it.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
That was
now
awesome.
Now we're back on the home court
in
the studio.
Yeah, we are back on home field.
Uh-huh.
We watched this movie successfully.
Yeah.
No drama this time around, except for your dog molesting me.
Oh, yeah. My dog is in heat, and she really likes males, and she's only around females.
Because she lives in a house with all girls in it, and so I walk in here loaded up with testosterone and can't help herself.
She was like trying to make out with him.
No.
Way too much. Try to mount him.
Even make out. It was like straight for the crotch and butt. Just focused on crotch and butt.
It was great. And she's usually like a really quiet, sweet dog. Like we've had her in the studio before, and she's so quiet and the best. But
this time she was going nuts.
Yeah.
And I mean, I get it. My crotch and my butt are probably my two best features,
right.
But still.
Right, especially to a dog. Oh, God. Yeah, that's great.
Anyway, it was sweet. We'll talk more about dogs in a second. First, I need to introduce our guest, who has written for dozens of different projects in film, TV, and web, including the hit web series Tiny Commando.
There it is.
I did my research. And I also learned we have one other thing in common, which is that we've both directed Tony Hawk.
Oh, really?
Welcome Jake Fleischer to the show.
Hello. Thank you guys for having me. I just have a quick question. Am I doing this podcast sitting in front of you, or am I arguing before you? Or am I...
Well, have you argued before me before?
This podcast.
I'm appearing before this podcast, which I've never done before, but I'm before it.
Yes,
we haven't.
Correct.
Okay. We haven't sworn you in officially yet.
Though I've never...
Order.
I don't know. Wait, do you know the oath? Do you want to swear a bit?
Uh-oh.
Oh,
I feel like you've done...
I'm a lawyer, not a bailiff, so it's not my job to swear people in, but I will say it's something about, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Probably not, given that this is a podcast.
Order.
I think. Wait, when did you?
We hold you in contempt.
When did you direct Tony Hawk? That's so cool.
This was a few years ago. Back a little short film I did for the Jason Ellis Show called The Woodsman that he made a cameo appearance in. Just a really shitty lo-fi horror comedy thing. He played an Australian guy. I told him, "Hey, Tony Hawk, when you say that line, look that way." It felt great. but I watched the thing you directed in him. That was funny.
It was all right. You know what was sad is like I wrote that sketch, you know, years before, and I wrote it. And then I think when I got involved with this company that started making all these sketches for Yahoo.
Right.
And when the X Games were in town, I was like, hey, do you want to do this? I sent it to them. And I was like, you know, because I was like, oh, it has talent involved. So they were excited. They did it. And then, like, I think right before that came out, College Humor did a sketch with Tony Hawk that was just so much better. And it was just so much better. I was like, well, I don't have to feel that bad because I was like, I wrote this because someone was like, what if I was Tony Hawk's doctor? And I was like, oh, yeah, great. I'll write that. And then 4 years later, we made it. And then right at the same time, College Humor did something right. Because I guess Tony Hawk was like on his, like, run of sketch comedy and was warming up with my shitty thing.
Oh, was he on a promotional tour or something?
I don't know. Something like that. I think he's sort of always on a promotional tour.
Yeah.
Like, but listen, the guy is, he's an ambassador.
He's a pro. For a not actor, he's acted in a lot of different projects.
Yes.
I think he's used to it.
Yes.
Yeah. Those college humor bastards. They think they're better just because they're college educated.
Just
humor can come from anywhere. You don't need a degree.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Okay, let's dive into our first segment where we ask our guest questions loosely inspired by the film in a segment called Inside Jake Fleischer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
oh no.
So I'm glad you're amused by all
that. Where did that come? Did that exist or did you make
it? No, that existed. It's from the film Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, because that's the Blast Off song.
Yeah, it's the Blast Off song.
That's right.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Okay, I don't want to spoil it. I haven't seen any.
Jackie hasn't seen any of the movies we're talking about.
Is that the point that you're.
Yeah.
Part of the point, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I'm a great co-host.
Yeah, the point is she's a great co-host, but that just happens to be a nice bonus.
That is a gimmick.
Every movie for the first time every time I watch it with Josh.
Oh, I thought you don't like you. I was thinking like you don't even watch. You're like I've literally we've got a.
Oh no
got
no.
A,
no yes
we've I got an Amish co-host who's never seen a movie. We occasionally show them little clips and they scream because they don't know how the people got in the box.
Yeah.
And
actually, I just watched them for the first time.
No, actually,
it's pretty hard to find a Mennonite podcast co-host.
She actually doesn't even watch the movies before the podcast. We just like having somebody in here who has no idea what we're talking about.
Like, this is a boring conversation. Let's move on.
Yeah, can we talk about something else?
Are we still talking about those two Jews?
Anyways, in the film Intolerable Cruelty, Marilyn Rexroth has a pack of Rottweilers, while Heinz the Baron Krauss von Espy has a tiny lap dog. Are you a large dog, a small dog, or a no dog person?
I am a small dog person.
You're a small dog person?
I'm a small dog person. I have a dog that, speaking of dogs that hump inappropriately, my dog is pretty. By the way, like when they hump, I find a lot of them hump pretty silently. So I can see you doing a podcast with a dog just going at it on someone's body part.
Oh.
And I can see it not even really being an issue. You know? You could certainly take it out in post. My dog is
so she's not making
panting.
Like yip noises. Yip.
They usually don't yip. Dogs kind of pant when they hump your legs.
No, I call my dog. My dog is a very cute dog. He's a fluffy. He looks like shag carpet. He's adorable. And when he does hump, I call him the mitten raper because he looks like he's going. He's like I've got mittens on and I'm committing terrible crimes. adorable and committing crimes.
Oh wait, I think you showed me a picture of your dog. I remember the mittens. I was like, oh, that's adorable.
Yeah, and he's on my Facebook page.
Right.
And he is. He won't be anywhere near on my Twitter @jfly. He won't be there. I'm a small dog person, 20 pounds, 18, okay. 19, 20 pounds.
A dog that you can kind of carry around with you, have like hanging out on your, you carry him around.
Yeah, but not sub 10, so he's still technically like a dog.
So
he does dog things.
Not like a purse dog.
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, you could put him in a purse and it would be hilarious and he would be sad in a very entertaining way.
Right.
But no, like that, not, you know, unless you want to.
Not something that you could conveniently carry around in the purse.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, yeah. That's not too small. That's not so small where
it's
like it seems
like a medium
like,
dog.
Yeah, where
or
it seems
a medium
like
medium dog guy.
Yeah,
to be fair,
you haven't like bred. It's not a toy dog where you like. It literally seems like a Furby that you've brought to life. And
but I would say
the
Baron von Sweetsensiphon's dog was not that small for a dog you're going to take into court and
but
not
it was
be.
No, Pomeranian though.
That was like that was a Pomeranian, right?
Yeah,
it was a pretty small. It seems bigger because it's like a big
fluffy.
Poof ball,
and he's a small man.
It's like a koosh ball of a dog.
Yeah, he's a small man,
and he's a small man.
That'll do it.
Jackie, you're not a small dog person.
No, I'm not. I am a big dog person. I have a husky.
Is your husky not cut? Is it au naturel?
Yeah, she's not.
Wow.
Scared. Yeah, because I got her from through a friend who they had rescued her, and for whatever reason they didn't spay her. Like I think they wanted her to have puppies, and once I got her, she's already an adult dog, and I just didn't want to like mess with her because sometimes it changes her personalities and stuff too.
Oh yeah, because if you do it, yeah, I get it.
Yeah,
you.
So she was like already like 4 or 5 years old, and I was like, I just don't want to put her through this trauma. And so she's not spayed.
So do you have to like put a diaper on her once a month? Oh,
it's not, no. It's not once a month. It's like once. It's not even twice a year. It's sort of like every 9 months, I would say.
That's how long a dog period is?
No, it's not that it's that long. It happens. in that interval. Okay. So they go into heat, like...
They're literally on the rag for, like, 3.5 months. Yeah. It's a nightmare, bro. It's a nightmare.
She wears a diaper for, like, a week, and it's super funny, and she's, like, she has such a good personality, so she'll deal with it, but you can tell she's just, like, so sad to be wearing a diaper.
Oh, yeah.
But it's adorable and cute, but yeah, so she's really amped up right now because she wants dude right now. So aww. Funny. That's why she loves Josh, especially.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. I should have come in there all temptingly, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You're just a big old tease.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, but she's a big dog, but she also kind of acts like a small dog. Like, she'll let me carry her down the street for no reason. She's like, okay, whatever, mom.
It is, yeah.
But it's good exercise.
That picture of, yeah, her in your lap is very, yeah, very bizarre.
I would imagine she's but a full size husky.
She's like, she's not that huge. She's like 47 pounds, but it's so big.
You know what you should do? You should put her on a sled and pull the sled around.
I
and
wish.
Like,
yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I know.
Do we love our dogs or what?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In LA, we pull the dogs on a sled.
I know. She would like it.
In Soviet Russia, we pull dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Do you ever get sick of that? Is that offensive to you?
The Soviet Russia jokes?
The Yakov Smirnov
jokes. Oh, are you
jokes?
Russian?
Oh, no. Yeah. I love it. I think it's so funny. Yeah, I'm not offended by that.
Okay. When did you That's move true. From Russia?
I actually was born here, but my family came in 78.
Okay.
And my siblings and I were born like in the 80s and 90s and stuff.
And so. You're like 100% sure your parents aren't Cold War sleeper agents. They're not.
Yes.
They're not the Americans.
You mean like the Americans?
They're not that?
Yeah, no.
100%.
100%.
It's okay because it's they have nobody to kill anymore because it's...
Yeah, no.
I mean, the Cold War Russians. Is over, supposedly. We don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but we still hate Russia, and Russia hates us.
Well, I think that we're actually starting to try and get it back going again.
Yeah,
we
I think
bored.
So.
Yeah.
Seems like it.
Now that we've pounded Al-Qaeda flat, we're like, let's go back to Russia.
We don't like what Putin's doing, yeah.
ISIS is so nebulous, it's more exciting to have Russia, because they're like a real country with like a real dictator, and like, oh yeah.
And I actually think that he is the guy, Vladimir Putin is like, He's like Kim Jong-un, but with better writers.
Uh-huh.
He's like a more believable... He's the Breaking Bad to Kim Jong-un's, like, you know, Spanish soap opera. He's just better, well-created fictional
narrative. I just think of him like he's crazy, but he seems like he's got a plan.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Don't fuck with
like,
him.
Like, Kim Jong-un is just, like, flying by the seat of his pants crazy.
You know, it's like that thing of like, oh, my God, I've never defecated, and I always shoot holes in one. And Vladimir Putin's like, twice a year I fight a bear.
Yeah.
Like, I take my bullshit down a notch.
just a tad. Just enough to be a believable human being.
Yeah.
So Miles Massey gives a keynote speech in front of a giant room in Caesar's Palace. Have you ever had to give a big speech? And if so, did you dramatically tear up your speech midway through and decide to give a different speech?
No. I will say this. I mean, I'd also noticed that it was like their organization is no man.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yep. Great.
Let no man tear asunder.
Let
yeah,
no
their
man.
Slogan.
It was so great. I mean, I've done a lot of stand-up, right?
Right. So okay, so that, yeah, it's public speaking experience.
Public speaking. But... And I feel like I've had a lot. And I will say that I have... And I've definitely gone off book. In terms of speeches, proper speeches, no, I don't think so. Because I think probably by the time I've decided to make a proper speech, I'm so egotistically in love with what I've written that I'm like, right. Oh, I can't wait to share this with the world. I can't wait. I am going to educate the shit out of their ears. And I think that's kind of my terrible personality.
Wait,
but
what
I haven't.
Kind of speech? Like, what kind of speech
well,
have you
okay,
done?
So I did a graduation speech, right, for eighth grade. And I've done,
bring it back. Uh-huh.
And I've done, you know, I did a speech at my vows. Like I wrote my vows for my wedding.
Right.
And
okay.
I wrote
right,
like a counts. Speech for my dad's 70th birthday party.
Okay.
And I think that
some speech experience. I like it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and it's funny at the speech experience from my dad, everyone afterwards was like, that was a great roast. And I was like, what do you mean roast? They were like, that was a roast. I was like, that wasn't a roast. It was just a funny speech. So like, nope, you pretty much just insulted your loving dad of, you know, for your whole life. You just ripped him apart in front of people. And thank God he's the kind of person who like would prefer that. But I just don't even realize it. Like my natural
speech.
Yeah,
that's funny about your relationship with your dad and even though you're roasting him.
And then what was best.
I thought it was a compliment.
And it was best on, when I got married very recently at the Beverly Hills Courthouse.
Buddy.
Thank you so much.
Congrats.
I gave like a very heartfelt speech and I thought it was pretty good. And then my wife being the perfect woman for me. Basically roasted me at the altar, like, and just really tore into me and gave a really funny speech and like made fun of me about my like ire about recycling, which she clearly had like I thought she gave me a pass on for 2 years, but it turns out she was just saving up for our wedding vows. So no, I've never really torn up, but I can. I can go off the cuff.
Yeah.
I.e., think about how entertaining I've been for the last 10 minutes. That's all off the cuff.
Right. But, oh, yeah, there's no notes here. But no, man, that's what love is. Love is just being able to, like, tear the shit out of another person, and it still doesn't mean anything.
Well, I think my dad also probably wanted a comedian for his son. I think he definitely wanted one.
That's so nice. No, it's nice that he wanted that, and you became that, because most parents want a lawyer or a doctor child, and then they get a comedian, they're like, I still love you. But
it's totally that.
Jackie, the perfect child.
Yeah, I know. You're a lawyer?
Yeah.
My sister's a doctor, and they got one right in her. They got it right.
No, but he wanted you.
I think he really did. My uncle was kind of like a failed comedian. My grandmother was a wild narcissist. My grandfather was a wild narcissist.
There you go.
And I think
it's in your blood.
It's kind of my blood. My dad loved being funny, and he was friends with some big comedians, so... I think he was happy with what he got, but...
Look, the three traditional Jewish jobs are law, medicine, and the entertainment industry.
Yes.
And we're all there.
We're all the perfect Jewish children.
Yeah, we're just fine.
No, but it's like that quote on 30 Rock, where they're like, and then the third generation takes improv classes and snowboards. They're like, and the second generation works hard, so the third generation can take improv classes and go snowboarding.
Well, that's really true, right? Is you've got the immigrant parents who have to scrape their way up to middle class, and then the middle class parents who scrape their way up to upper class, and then the upper class kids who just fart it all away.
Do coke.
You know what we do?
The cycle continues.
We roll the dice. Like, we really roll the dice. Like, we're probably going to end up destitute, but we're rolling the dice on the millions. We're like, maybe.
Yeah. Right.
That's what entertainment is.
Taking a big gamble, exactly.
Totally.
All right, one last question before we dive into the movie review. This film ends with a taping of a show called America's Funniest Divorce Videos. Jake, I'm curious, because I know you have show pitching experience. Could you try pitching America's Funniest Divorce Videos to us? How would you do it?
Well, I would say it's kind of like... I would say it's... Okay, it's like Cheaters meets America's Funniest Home Video.
Right.
You know, it's about going through the best evidence that's been submitted, right?
Yeah.
And the best sort of courtroom breakdowns and the best deposition testimonies. And then we do a clip show about it. And I got to tell you, if you go on YouTube, there are some amazing clips out there. Like, I'll play some right now.
Yeah.
They're so hilarious.
I should have had some clips queued up just for this occasion.
So that's what I would do. I would be like, and then if I felt like it wasn't working in the room, I would be like, but you don't understand. I mean, this is a human story. It's not only entertaining and funny, it's also as a human element, and it's about something that 50% of all married people go through. It's so
half of Americans get divorced, the other half thinks about getting divorced. It applies to everybody.
I would say
universal.
I would say it's Cheaters meets America's Funniest Home Videos.
That's great. I don't know if in real life
I like it.
I don't know if in real life if this was pitched a network would actually go for it. It seems very specific.
Yeah, but these days there's a reality TV show for any topic, so I feel like it could be.
By the way, when you think about how many deposition videos leak and get played a lot, if you had you could do a clip show on deposition disasters.
You probably could. Yeah,
and they're all videotaped, so all that footage is out there. You just have to get it released.
Or I'd love to see, I don't know, reenactments, because sometimes, you can't tape the trial, but you still have to tape to the transcript. You could just, reenact the craziest things that happened on trial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be entertaining. I think this is a show.
I think we should. Okay, everyone listening, copyright Pat Pending.
Yep.
Pat Pending.
If you say copyright on a podcast, it's copyrighted.
But it's not patented.
But if I say Pat Pending, it's Pat Pending.
Is it trademarked?
No, it has not.
You can't patent that.
It's copyrighted, trademarked, and patented.
No. I'm patenting, not patenting that. I'm patenting the quick verbal patent.
Sorry to be the legal voice of reason, but you can't patent an idea.
I'm patenting disagreeing with a lawyer. I patent that.
No trademark, no patent here, but maybe some copyright.
Maybe copyright?
Yeah, maybe if you write down a treatment.
Okay, you know what I'm going to write?
Not the idea. Anybody listening to this podcast can take this idea and run with it.
Okay.
You can't take this idea, Pat Pending.
Okay, we're going to take this podcast and put it on an iPod and then mail the iPod to ourselves.
So
that makes it an official copyright. No?
No, but okay.
All right. Okay.
We have
a legal podcast that I help and dispense advice.
Legal issues podcast. That could actually
And I'll get in a lot of trouble with the bar because you're not supposed to do that, but sure, we'll do it anyway.
What I do is whenever I do a podcast, I have someone with an eidetic memory sitting in the corner, and then I mail that person to myself in a box with some food in it.
That's human memory is unreliable.
No, not if it's
not if they got the
actual phonographic memory. That means everything sounds like a bad wax recording.
Thomas Edison had a photographic memory.
They remember everything like this. And then the square root of the hypotenuse is a thing with a thing, thing, thing. It's a phonographic memory.
Okay, on that note, it's time to dive into the movie of the week in a segment called The Big Reviewski. Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. The film Intolerable Cruelty, released in 2003, starring George Clooney and Catherine Zeta-Jones. we should just say right off the bat, this is widely considered the beginning of the Coen's low point, at least critically.
Sorry.
No, because we just came out of a big string of movies. I'd say if you look at their entire canon, about from Barton Fink to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, would be considered kind of a Coen Brothers golden age.
Yeah.
Where they're just hidden every time out. That doesn't mean there aren't great movies coming, because there are great movies coming, but that was just like their big early string that kind of cemented them as great filmmakers. And then Intolerable Cruelty was the beginning of that drop-off. At least, I'm not necessarily saying that off the bat. I'm going to hold off on my official opinion, but that's the conventional wisdom.
Can I tell you why I think that is?
Why?
Because I think this, and especially Lady Killers, them sort of basically being like, we are in love with an older form of movie making that has gone out of fashion. And we are so good, we just want to make the movies that we used to like. And we're going to remake an older style of comedy. I don't care if people don't like it, because this movie is so well crafted. It's so well made.
Mm-hmm.
It is phenomenal piece of like craft work. And when you watch it like that, when you watch like a podcast.
Are you talking about Intolerable Cruelty?
Intolerable Cruelty. It's amazingly well made. But then you're like, oh, they're clearly doing something for themselves, not for an audience. That was kind of my vibe.
Right. It's interesting you say that, because I didn't necessarily get that vibe. I think it is generally well crafted, but I also think this is the first time the Coen brothers have kind of, I don't want to use the word sell out, but...
Yeah, I'm going to use that word.
Wasn't necessarily trying to make their own auteur vision and was trying to make something that was a more typical studio audience-friendly comedy.
You know, it's so funny. Coming from a comedy writing perspective, which we all do... Mm-hmm. You're like, it almost felt like they were doing their version of a Hollywood rom-com. And they were basically being like, we're throwing it back to like Spencer Tracy and Groucho Marx, and we're going to do all this really heightened, crazy stuff.
No question it is a throwback. No question it's a throwback to, they're in love with that era of screwball comedies.
Yeah.
And they were bringing a lot of that style and a lot of that kind of old Cary Grant classic movie star back and forth dialogue into this.
And the whole thing had a very heightened, I mean, the bad word is stilted, the proper word is, I don't know, like stylized thing, but that, on purpose, you know, in the same way the Grouch, you know, the Marx Brothers is stilted because it's so hyper real and ridiculous.
Right.
But I felt like it's funny. Like I just was kind of like, it felt like a whole bunch of people at the top of their game dicking around. That's what I thought this movie was.
See,
in a way that like made themselves feel so good.
Now when you say guys at the top of their game dicking around, I'm kind of siding with you. This and The Lady Killers, which was literally a remake of an old film, and Gambit, which we talked about, which started getting written around this time, but was also literally a remake of an old film.
What was Gambit?
Gambit was a movie that only came out on DVD, and the Coen brothers wrote but didn't direct, but was a remake of like a 60s film starring
Did
Michael
it star
Caine.
Ja Rule and Eric Roberts? Was it like a super strange DVD?
Oh, I know it starred Colin Firth and Cameron Diaz.
Wow,
it had a semi-legitimate cast in it.
Yeah.
They were going for movies that had broader appeal while also trying to incorporate a throwback sensibility of this is the way like old blockbusters used to be.
Well, it kind of looked like that too. Like it was 2003, but it looked like 94 to me. Just this, like visually,
right?
It looked old, which was interesting.
Well, talking about the making of this a little bit, the first official Coen Brothers movie that they did not come up with the story or write the first draft of the script. The story came from a guy named John Romano. I want to say he also wrote the movies Knights in Rodanthe and The Lincoln Lawyer.
Huh.
So, you know.
I think it was, I mean, I feel like someone wrote this as a very standard rom-com. It's like yeah, a lady falls in love with her divorce, with the divorce lawyer who's bringing against her, and then they kind of do their thing, but they still fall in love. But then the Coen brothers were like, we're going to make this like a 1940s comedy.
Yeah, took the rom-com elements and maybe added more elements of classic farce to it, which is.
And probably kept it really dark.
Yeah. It is, and it is. It's really interesting, the take on love in this film, because it is the Coen brothers' only romantic comedy. It is the Coen brothers' only movie where, like, love is the focus. And there are moments where it seems like they have kind of an optimistic love conquers all take, and other moments where it seems very cynical, that love is just something foolish people do, and they get, you know, tricked into losing all their money.
Right, yeah. So not even, but it makes it seem like it's not even love. It's like people get, it's like a marriage movie, not as much as it's like a love movie. And it's like people get married just to get each other's money and like have prenups. So I found it enjoyable, but not because it was like a deep, profound Coen Brothers film that made me think.
Not at all.
But again, as one of those late night specials where I'm maybe falling asleep for a few seconds here or there, it was fun just to watch. But like, I think I personally found the lawyering part of it kind of funny, but it was definitely just like a rom-com. Like it wasn't like, to me, it wasn't like a Coen Brothers film. It was like, you know,
that's the thing, at least
with like a drop of Coen Brothers, but not even really. Like there weren't even that many very specific Coen Brothers elements to me so far from what we've watched.
No, I agree with you. And having been going through all these movies and looking for elements of that auteur sensibility, I wasn't seeing it as much here.
Except I would say the acting. I would say the performances felt very, and the acting and the casting, like who they put in the film, how they shoot their faces, like that scene where he's giving the speech.
I disagree with that.
When he's giving the speech and the thing, and like just who they want to put, who they want to populate their movies with, I thought was like, I felt that was so Coen Brothers, like those weird, all the weird looking dudes in the
John
Man
Turturro,
speech.
So to me, it's not.
It's true that we're missing out on John Turturro and John Polito and John Goodman and Michael Badalucco and a lot of their classic cast.
I felt like that old guy was like pure hudsucker. I mean, in his own way, he was
That's one I would single out as definitely Coen Brothers' touch, is the 100-year-old lawyer who's been like sitting in this dark room.
But
forever.
I didn't even like his character that much, to be fair. Because it was a little disjointed from the rest of the movie in a way that like it was too far of a stretch in my opinion.
No,
like,
that's what you mean.
Too dark.
It was weird and dark, but that's not necessarily bad.
Right, but it wasn't connected. Like
I think it might have. It felt tacked on to somebody else's story.
It could have been not in there, and it wouldn't have mattered. That's what I didn't like about his character.
At the end of the day, I think once you're like, once you're like 50, 60 minutes into the film, you're like, oh, I get what this guy is. He is what George Clooney
my fucking
real
nightmare. Yeah, if I ever
you said that even before George Clooney literally had a nightmare about him. You were like, oh my god, that is my nightmare. Yeah. It's becoming,
like, muttering about billable hours until I'm like connected by an IV to my desk.
Right,
that will never happen to me.
In that sense, that I think, because it's interesting, because you are bringing like an actual lawyer perspective, and it's interesting that rang as true to you. I think even if the law in this movie was in large part kind of movie law and not real law, it's good that it kind of maybe felt true on another level.
Yeah, it did. It was
through the lawyer experience.
Also the lawyering wasn't that bad in this movie. Like, I'm very critical, obviously, of any TV show or movie that has law in it, because I'm like, that's absurd. That would never happen. But this was not that bad. So I'll give it credit for that. They had good like lawyer consultants on this, obviously.
That's good.
Yeah.
I read one take online saying that from one very angry lawyer.
Shut up.
Taking apart Intolerable Cruelty, saying California pioneered no-fault divorce cases. And so the fact that they're constantly looking for fault in these cases would make a lot of the trials kind of irrelevant. And that short marriages wouldn't necessarily lead to huge payouts for the wife in general in California anyways.
But yeah, but even if it's no fault, I don't think that they were putting them on the stand in order to figure out, like, is there a reason to get divorced? They're trying to figure out the money and who deserves the money. And I think that that's stuff that the judge would look at. Like, were you aiming to just get money out of this?
Right.
So I think that's why it actually, those proceedings were kind of relevant.
I also think that, and I think this kind of gets in my head, in my fantasy world, into why this movie is the way it is and how they made it and why they made it the way they did, is that I find with romantic comedies, you get more hand waving about realities and plot and things like that than you do in anything else, because You know, it's like more than almost any other type of movie, I feel, especially with comedies. It's about the humor. It's about the actors. It's about the relationship. And all that other stuff is like, whatever. We'll just, I know we have to have a third act, whatever. We'll just have something happen and they'll fall in love or whatever.
You just have,
and I think these movies become so, they become so unreal and so artificial. And when you're like trying to pitch them, you're just trying to like think of like, I don't know, like what, like you watch movies that are about something. They're very rarely are comedies about something. They're like just kind of like an excuse to get the next, you know, give these people their next acting role in a comedy movie to do their funny thing.
And one response to knowing that there are always all these artificial plot and obstacles in a romantic comedy is just to, you know, play up the artificiality.
Yes,
of the whole thing
exactly.
And just make it big and make it ridiculous, which I think the Coens specialize in.
And I think they probably, I mean, if they're like me, which I would probably say they're probably a lot better than me, but I know I go, I'm like, man, I can't believe we got to deal with these stupid story notes and these stupid story things because nobody's watching it for that and nobody cares and all these movies are so stupid and, you know, like I think a lot of these romantic comedies are so dumb and the reason why they're being made is so more about what they're getting across, not the story they're telling. And I can see them
just... what they're getting across, like... love,
humor, humor, performances, comedy, and you know, and the stars.
But I feel like the point of all those rom-coms is just to like give you like this little warm fuzzy feeling of like, oh, it's so cute, like love
exactly.
works out,
yeah.
And then even those other elements, I would say, like aren't even as important. Like you forget.
But I would just say all it says is like the story that you're telling is almost interchangeable, and it ends up being so interchangeable that it's like I could see why they decided to do this romantic comedy and do it so heightened and crazy.
I will say, compared to the average romantic comedy, I feel like this belongs to a very specific subgenre of romantic comedy, which is the one where I'm thinking of like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, or that one of like Clive Owen and Julia Roberts, where they're both like, I forget, I think they're like super spies who are spying on each other.
Corporate espionage, industrial espionage.
Corporate espionage movie. I forget what the name of that was. But it's like where you have two like a superpowered man and a superpowered woman who are like playing big games with each other at the same time that they're secretly falling in love on the side.
Yeah.
Which... those other movies has always struck me as kind of a ridiculous subgenre. Are you really going to fall in love with this person you're playing corporate espionage strategy games with?
And look at how fast the turns are. You know, like when he decides to marry her, it's so fast. And when they decide to fall in love, it's so fast.
Right.
You're just like, ugh.
Every time it's a jump from, okay, first kiss, let's get married instantly.
Yeah, that's just because the movie was like kind of silly. But I could see how when you're opposing somebody, you could get into these like very quick, like heightened, intense feelings.
Oh my God. Because they're like, they do what you do and they do it so well. And you're like, if your life is about work and then you meet somebody whose life is about work, you're like, oh, we're kind of making a baby together.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I think
people.
Wow.
I hate people.
This is the Jackie soundboard.
I love
your face. Do it again. Do it again.
What? Just throw them all out there.
Spoiler alert.
We have a guest.
Oh, I forgot to cover the guest.
Yeah.
Is there something you want for your soundboard that I could do right now?
Well,
what do you want? I'll go do anything. I'll do like, oh no, he didn't.
We can't really use it.
Yeah. The problem is it's just the Jackie soundboard.
Because he likes to interrupt me with myself too. That's
swipe
the best part.
Left.
Oh, that's a good one.
Right.
We have both swipe left and swipe right.
It's too quiet though.
Yeah.
Yield.
Make me louder. Do you mind?
Sure.
Thanks. She would never do that. She would never do that.
There we go.
That's better.
I hate people.
I'm the worst.
So unrealistic.
I'm the worst. Yeah, and speaking of that, I wasn't even talking about how unrealistic it was. Because usually I always complain about how unrealistic the relationships are between especially the female characters and the males. But I actually could see how in this like stupid situation she would be like into him because all she cares about is power and money. And she sees somebody who's like powerful that she could mess with.
And they both view love as like they both have
a conquest
and a thing to capture and a thing to defeat.
Yeah.
Right.
So I get their relationship.
Catherine said it to
Joseph's mom. Suck at making out.
Catherine. you didn't like their kisses at all.
They were so lame and gross and uncomfortable. I was like, just get into it. Just get into it.
You were like, well, let's just, you know, you keep saying penetrate. Let's see it.
Right. How impenetrable is it, really? Let's
find out. That is, by the way, that would be a great type of...
porn parody?
Pornography to do, which would be doing very, like, very well shot, cinematically matching hardcore porn scenes to put into movies, so it looks like the movie turned into hardcore porn that goes back to regular.
Oh, to like splice into an existing movie just to bring people
seamlessly,
out.
Yeah. Seamlessly splice hardcore penetration.
Get a George Clooney lookalike and a Catherine Zeta Jones exactly. lookalike and be like, wow, how did this get a PG-13? What is going on?
Director's cut?
It's like a full cream pie situation.
Yeah, anyway, you're like, yeah. What?
Oh my god, ridiculous.
That would be like a whole, and you would probably have to be like, all right, we're going to sell you these five scenes and tell you where to cut it in on your DVD. So rip the DVD, mm-hmm. do this, and then that's the package. Pat Pendick. Pat Pend.
Pat Pend, copyright, trademark.
No.
One thing you did find unrealistic was when they called a surprise witness. You were like, they don't do surprise witnesses.
Yeah,
which I was really disappointed to find out.
And the surprise witnesses aren't announced by seven different bailiffs.
I didn't see Derek Krause for this.
So great. Didn't find that to be very Coen Brothers?
That was great. That was very Coen Brothers.
That was Coen Brothers, to be right. And that character
was
Coen Brothers.
There were those touches. Both of those characters, those
creeps. The touches were so light. Such light. It was such a light touch. You know what I mean? That was disappointing.
There weren't enough of those touches to me. I would have liked to see more of that craziness, because those were my favorite parts of the movie.
Okay, but Clooney and his associate, I forgot the associate's name. That was
Wrigley.
Okay, but that was almost Coen Brothers-esque, but not quite, because they were too different. But like the two of them doing their thing.
Yeah. Oh my god, they were so good together.
Notice in a lot of scenes where Clooney's talking, he's just kind of like mumbling. He's not saying anything, but he's like moving his lips, like bah, 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 bah. Just mirroring everything he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. At parts, I like that guy. At parts, that guy was annoying the crap out of me.
Agree. But wait, so back to the surprise witness.
Surprise!
Yeah. What I think is funny about that too is when we were watching it, you were surprised that surprise witnesses isn't a thing, but when I did the very first episode of JFIO on your first podcast, I specifically mentioned that surprise witnesses is not a thing. And you specifically were like, but no, that makes it so less entertaining. And then you said the exact same thing when we were watching this, which is funny because that's a big thing for you.
I blocked that out because I want to live in a world where lawyers can call surprise witnesses to the stand.
I mean, completely impossible.
That just would make trials way more exciting.
I'll allow it. I'll allow it.
Wait.
I'll allow it.
How dare you?
I'll allow it.
Add another one later of me saying, how dare you, which is when people try to use my phrases.
This is as close as they have to how dare you.
Ugh. How dare you is coming next.
Anyway, yeah.
Objection.
I would just
you
love
put
it.
Put that in a sound. Objection. What about that?
That we should have an objection.
I will not allow it. Okay.
Fine. But I would have loved it if, during the O.J. Simpson trial, they're just like, we have a surprise witness! And they call, Jerry Rice. I know.
I'm sorry.
Well, what if...
I don't make the laws, I just swear to uphold them.
Do they allow, let's say you have a witness based on evidence that has just come to light. Like, they do that sometimes, too. They're like, we have this person based on this thing that just came up because our investigator was working during the trial and we want to call them. Does that ever happen?
Not like that. You would have to, you'd like make motions in front of the judge.
I knew it was going to involve making motions. Making motions.
Every time I say I'm working on emotion, Josh thinks I'm saying
Working on emotion.
Yeah,
I'm working on emotion.
From improv, I'm working on displaying emotion. I'm saying the motion that I would write. You would have to,
I made a motion
in a trial,
my pants.
Whoa. In a trial,
try saying that at your next trial.
Baby made a motion. Time to change the baby because he made a motion.
Yeah, no.
I'm sorry.
You have to have time to just prepare your witness. You know, you have to have the right to be prepared for trial and not have your interest prejudiced and all that. So there's just no such thing as a true surprise witness.
It's always preparation and everything takes forever. It's bullshit.
Yeah, the justice system.
Let's just hold
justice slowly.
The crime happened today. Let's just hold the trial tomorrow and let's just do whatever we think.
That's my favorite thing when that's my favorite thing on legal TV shows where one plot plays out in the course of 24 hours, but a plot trial plays out in the course of the same amount of time, and the trial would really be taking 3 months. And I was like, you can't go on one date over the course of... I mean, you can, but this is happening in 24 hours, and that's happening in 3 months. Your TV show's bullshit. Motion.
You should just have they should have improv trials where the lawyers show up and we're like, okay, here's all the facts about the case. Go.
Yeah. Nah.
just start talking.
Well, at this rate, because
we pitched that, the great debate.
Essentially, right? Yeah, we did pitch that.
Debate.
Except that there weren't any legally binding consequences from it.
No, it was. You would have to, it would be like Judge Judy, where you agree to That's what they do in those things. You sign a thing that says, I'm going to... That's what you do with fake TV show law.
Yeah.
Is you have to sign something ahead of time that says, this is bullshit, but I still am going to agree with it.
Agree with it. That's so funny.
That's a good idea.
Pat Pend.
We'll add that to the soundboard. We'll add Pat Pend.
Pat Pend. Ugh. I will object to it every time.
So I agree with you that there are some big Coney performances in here, like the old guy and the Baron.
Clooney was huge in this.
I did like Clooney's performance.
Well, let's talk about Clooney and Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Let's talk about that.
George Clooney, we talked about in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and I thought that, and I mentioned that while I thought he was fine, I thought it was one of the film's slight weak spots that he could have been playing it up a little bit more.
You thought he should have been playing it up more. You should have been hamming up more in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Yeah, yeah. Not necessarily hamming it up more, but like that I felt like his character seemed a little bit detached and wasn't necessarily feeling the drama.
Okay.
But I think he was supposed to.
I think so too. I think that was
the point of him, but I get you. Yeah.
And I thought there was also a vibe.
It was deliberate, but I still disagreed with that choice.
Right.
This vibe in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou where you want to see George Clooney as the main character, but you kind of get the vibe that he might be a bit of a sociopath. You're like, oh, and I think that's kind of one of those things where it's like with the Coen brothers, a lot of times you don't get to have your cake and eat it too. And like, you don't get to have George Clooney be the main character and love him.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, okay. It's different here. He's definitely not playing a sociopath here. He's playing a guy who has this, big slick exterior.
Well, he's playing a lawyer. Are you sure?
He's playing this super slickster, huckster lawyer type. But as the film goes on, you kind of see him get more and more unraveled and the flop sweat really starts to show. And he's going for it. I actually liked his performance a lot here.
I did too. I thought it was really fun.
I mean, I thought it was like a big caricature performance.
Yeah.
It struck me as very unvain.
Yeah,
absolutely. I love to see. And Billy Bob Thornton, him and Billy Bob Thornton.
I love Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah, it was great to see him again. Yeah.
Like, you're kind of like, oh my God. Like, these guys, if George Clooney was worse looking and Billy Bob Thornton was less serious, they could be on Saturday Night Live. They're so funny. They're so funny.
They are really sharp. I thought Clooney was really sharp here and generally playing to his strengths and giving it his all and super game, and it worked.
I loved his face in it, and I appreciate that he went that far to like be like really silly.
You talked about last time how his teeth are too perfect. And,
right, yeah, yeah. So in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I was like, oh my God, his teeth are like way too perfect for the time period and his character.
Yeah.
And then like the first thing we see of it, and it was like last week or whatever when we did that, and it was just so funny to like see his teeth for so long before you saw his face. It was like weirdly validating. It was really weird. It was great.
Right, yeah. It's just all teeth.
Like, and he's obsessed with his teeth. Yeah.
Yeah, this time they made the teeth a plot point.
Yeah. It's just funny.
Did you get this vibe that you were like, oh, you got to do this in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Now we're going to, hey, come back. Do the same thing. Just do it bigger and have more fun.
If anything,
did you get that vibe? Like, they were just like,
if anything, I feel like Clooney wanted to go back because I know he's a giant Coen Brothers fan and really wanted to work with them on Oh Brother. And I think it worked out well enough that when they decided to go in a more studio friendly direction, they were like, okay, well, we know one of the biggest movie stars in the world. Let's just.
How did it do studio wise?
Not well.
Did fine, no, but not incredibly
35
well.
35 domestic.
Okay, 35. Oh,
which is
less than I thought.
I think I looked it up today. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that this would have trouble finding an audience. And I don't know that I would enjoy watching it if I wasn't watching it, like, not to say that this is academic, but this is the most academic thing I've done in ages. Other than the stress dream I had last night.
For me, it's like the total opposite. I was like, this is so relaxing and like not my life.
It can be academic and relaxing at the same time.
No, I feel like people would. It's such a break, so it's just, I love that contrast.
I feel like once you get like tenure in academia, it's very relaxing. You just get to just talk about whatever bullshit you want for the
Except if you want to challenge yourself, Josh. Except if you're challenging
That's
yourself.
That's like us. Sure, we're tenured because we do a podcast. We're like,
ooh. Nobody's going to fire us from this shit.
But I thought, where George Clooney's character was at. He was like, he had nothing left to challenge him.
That's what's interesting, and I saw somebody make this point online that this is one of the rare Coen Brothers protagonists that starts the movie on top of the world with nothing to lose, with nothing left to win.
Yeah,
that like our Miles Massey has already gotten like everything he could possibly dream of.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't have a woman
except love.
Yeah, but he doesn't want love. He doesn't realize he wants love.
Yeah, but he wants sex. I don't know. He wants something.
But he can get sex.
Yeah, but he wants more exciting sex.
He wants Catherine Zeta-Jones. Let's talk about Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yeah, let's talk about her.
This was probably like at the height of her stardom. And as this movie was sold, I'm sure it was just sold as, Clooney's Zeta-Jones vehicle. Like, this is what got this movie made.
Yeah.
she has this air of being very sophisticated, and she's always cast in roles that makes her kind of be this very like kind of upper class sexy woman. I don't
so
buy
annoying.
It. I don't think she's that upper class. She's just like a random actress to me.
I think she's definitely the hottest Mexican Welsh person I've ever met in my life.
That's right. She does have that weird gene combo.
Is she? No, I don't even know if it is. I think she's just straight Welsh, but people just cast her as Latina all the time.
Because she does.
Is she straight Welsh?
Something like that.
I don't think she's straight Welsh. I think she, yeah, look it up, Jackie. I think she's some weird combination of cultures. But if she was just Kathy Jones, I don't think people would give a shit as much.
Kathy Jones, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Of course not. Yeah. She really plays it up.
I don't know. You know what? She was gorgeous.
She is gorgeous.
I mean, you know
what?
Stunning was High Fidelity. Because she was meant to be like the unattainable hottest girl you ever were with, and
well, she's kind of that here too. She's kind of the unattainable, like ultimate woman, except she's also playing more of this, you know, man eater caricature.
They definitely did not have any really strong female comic roles in this. Maybe her friend a little. Some of the bimbos. The fucking train scene. The train scene where he's back when he has his heart attack.
Yeah.
And the thing where he strangles the guy, where he goes red in the face. That guy's great.
Rex Rexroth. Yeah, Rex Rexroth had fun. And what a great name, too.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I liked him.
But
I think she's Welsh. Sorry.
Okay, maybe she is just Welsh.
Yeah.
And I understand everybody's got weird fetishes, but still, how do you really just get off on like jumping on the bed singing "I've Been Working on the Railroad" with a bunch of pot ladies?
No,
that seems impossible.
That and
why is that impossible? People
but here's, like, the okay, thing, here's the thing. Here's the thing. In the inserted pornography scene version of this movie, it would go from that to a pornography scene perfectly matched on a train bed. Back into the thing, and then that's where the product Pat Pan comes in.
It's one thing if you're like, I'm going to be the train babe, and you're going to be the tunnel and make choo-choo noises as you're doing it, and that can be a thing. But if you're literally just singing kids songs and jumping up and down, that doesn't seem erotic in any way, shape, or form.
Nope.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe if you wanna tweet me at Radio TFB and tell me, you
tell
know what is my greatest
fetish?
It's my greatest fantasy. you can totally
yeah,
prove me wrong.
I don't. I think they just. I think that was like the very cartoonish version of like,
yeah,
this is what, I mean, maybe we came in on the scene in between like, you know, in between 18 hour sex marathons.
Right.
We're going to have sex for 18 hours, then we're going to jump on the bed and make train noises.
Yeah,
then
it's
we're
just
gonna
like
have sex
a little intermission. Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. It made sense to me. I feel like people just like weird stuff.
Okay.
So that's just, sorry, that's my contribution to this conversation.
Based on your personal experiences?
No. I don't have anything like that. But I'm just saying, I feel like if you're drunk and messing around and being silly, you're just being silly, and that can just like turn you on or whatever. Right. So I could just see that would be like a thing that they're like, oh, it's so
fair
funny
enough.
Only to us. But
this is, you know, like, I mean, this is like insight. Pretty silly, and I've got just a giant, you know.
Yeah.
Hard on.
Oh yeah, we're both sitting here with the giant throbbing
giant
emergency.
Yeah, good thing my
erections.
Dog isn't here. Anyway.
Yeah, really.
One thing I liked about that scene, it was one of those things in this movie where you're like, what does this have to do with anything? And then it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Like the old guy, oh my God, he was so funny. And the scene with him and his guys being like, watch that deposition, pull this one in, pull the Zuckerberg thing in. That was so funny. No, but that's what I liked about the old guy. Is that he totally didn't make sense. And then, you know, 50 minutes into it or 60 minutes into it, you're like, oh, this is like, he grows up to be a man who has a machine. He's like Dick Cheney. He's got a machine instead of a heart. He's literally like a totally soulless, heartless human being. And that's what George
And he's
Clooney's
the one who
become.
Eventually convinces them to like hire the hitman for the good of the firm. Yeah.
And God, that guy was fun. That was so, that was pretty
Wheezy,
Coen Brothers.
The entire Wheezy Joe scene and the way Wheezy Joe went out, that's probably the purest Coen Brothers touch in the whole film.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that that was Foley, or was that guy making that noise?
I think a bit of both. I think he was probably making a noise, and they might have been overdubbing it. Because the Coens can be very particular about their sound design, spraying the inhaler at them, and then shooting himself in the mouth. But perfect, just a perfectly executed slapstick gag. Those are the moments I liked. But there, I feel like there were too many other moments in between that felt. They didn't have as much personality, that felt a little bit generic in comparison. You know, the Coen brothers had their whole production team here. They had Carter Burwell doing the music. They had Roger Deakins doing the cinematography.
Which didn't seem that way.
But it didn't seem that way. It felt fairly indifferently shot, and the music felt pretty stock. Yeah. And unlike the I missed the period specificity of the other movies. This one felt like it was set in modern day LA just because it could, just because that's the easiest place to set a movie.
And also, like, I'm sure sure they have like 10,000 friends going through messy divorces too, because they live in Hollywood. Like, I'm sure that this was,
you know what, I bet that's true.
What did they say about it? Like, what did the Coens say about it now?
I could find a lot of them talking about this film.
You could not?
Honestly. I couldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. But they don't also acknowledge it.
They also say that, like, I find them to be like always. They're like, oh, this film doesn't have any meaning. Isn't that their shtick? Where they're always oh, it doesn't mean anything.
Oh, sure.
They're like, it totally does. It's so obvious.
They say that this time they didn't say that, which means it's true, but it has no meaning.
No, they do say about all their films, you shouldn't read too much into it. But in this case, because they didn't come up with the story themselves, they didn't write the first draft of the screenplay, they were brought in. This is more of a hired gun project for them. So I think it legitimately might not have as much meaning to them. Yeah, real quickly, my thing about Catherine Zeta-Jones is that she's not openly bad here. And part of the problem is that her character is a little bit underwritten. She's written as basically just this kind of this man-eater who doesn't seem to have a whole lot of inner life or a whole lot of goals outside of just, you know, taking down powerful men for their
Which
money.
Which is a type of person, so that wasn't bad on its own.
Right.
But she didn't have enough, like, variety in what she was doing because, like, some parts really worked, I think, where, like, her kind of coldness and aloofness and fake poshness.
But you've got to show that there's somebody behind that.
Right. You do. Definitely underdeveloped.
Except, what I would say is, did the surprise work on you? Because the surprise worked on me.
Oh, what, the big twist?
Yeah.
Oh, I fell for the big twist.
Because I think underwriting a character, even though it's bad for drama and stuff like that, I think it does help you underestimate the character and let the twist work harder from an audience's perspective.
Yes, the twist worked.
That is true.
Which I was kind of asleep
for. But from a character and chemistry perspective, I find it disappointing.
Sure. I agree. And so I think, like, just the fact that she was playing the same thing the entire time, not enough connection to other certain parts.
Yeah.
So, which, like, to me, my biggest issue with her was, like, they didn't seem like they were really into each other unless they were looking at each other. So, like, the looks were great because I was like, right. I get it. I see them, like, eyeing each other in this, like, really specific way. But then when they were, like, physically together, it was this, like, really, like, posh, fake, not real kissing. Like, it was really weird, which I guess makes sense for characters not, like, really into him. But I feel like it would have been more satisfying if it was, like, you know, attached at the mouth, like, all over each other, like, really into it. Because then it would have been, believable.
A little bit of passion. And because this was kind of a throwback to those pre-Hays Code, you can't really show that much passion on screen kind of movies. Maybe it was a deliberate choice, but still.
Nah, I'm not buying it.
I'm not really buying it either. I didn't even see as much chemistry as you did. I didn't think there was a ton of chemistry.
I thought their looks were pretty meaningful.
It made a ton of sense for him on Clooney's end. And Clooney's character was having to do sort of all the work here. It made sense. Like, that's that tennis scene, that what am I going to do scene, scene in the...
And he does have this that kind of epiphany where, like, he realizes he doesn't want to end up alone his whole life. And he does have this speech where he comes out and he says the first lines of his speech and realizes that I'm just not the same man I used to. I'm going to read you literally the notes that I took during that scene. Oh, come on, please don't abandon your big corporate speech midway through to say something heartfelt. Oh, shit, he's going to do it. Fuck, he did it. And then, please don't break into unexpected applause as soon as he leaves the stage. God damn it, they're slow clapping. Don't do it. Don't do it. God damn it. Standing ovation.
Well, and I think that I don't think that they did that to be like, oh, we're really going to pull one over on the audience. And we're like, I think they did that to make fun of it. Because look at that. That's where I love that cutaway to that goofy guy with the big teeth.
Yeah.
Like, in the audience, I was just like, look at that guy. That guy's so funny looking. And then later on, he's like, great speech, man. Great. Like, I love... Like, they never took anything in this movie too seriously.
Right. I mean,
they certainly didn't take
it. Maybe it was supposed to be a play on that trope.
And he's like, I'm going to go do in South Central or
I'm going to do pro bono work in South Central or something.
And that to me is like, that's like the end of Mars Attacks when he's like, and maybe we could all live in teepees because probably that's better. I love that. I love him.
I like during his big speech when he says, love is good. Love is good.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, okay, there you go. I guess that is like the banal sentiment that you're kind of undermining in this film is, love isn't just good. Sometimes love is just a convenient marriage of people who don't want to die alone.
And isn't there something to be said for like that sort of like formulaic up and down or right we're right before the bottoming out at the end of the second act, which is him finding out that she tricked him, mm-hmm. that they do this big up, and you know, you look at that Sid Field screenplay diagram, which is it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. And this is almost them being like, yeah, okay, yeah, we're going to do that, but that shit's bullshit.
Right.
Like, we're going to do that, but this formulaic shit is bullshit. It is, so we're just going to do the formula. We're going to color the numbers in the most vibrant, obvious colors we can, because coloring by the numbers is obnoxiously boring.
It is, yeah. It is.
I don't know. I mean,
no, it is.
I might be reading too much into it.
It no, I don't. I this is what we do here. We read too much into movies.
but at least we're experts.
Yeah.
You might be.
I like that they undercut that trope a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You're right that it makes sense. I think it did make sense for George Clooney's character, that they gave him enough of a motivation that it made sense. I don't know if it made as much sense for Marilyn, because she is kind of a cipher here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
She would never do that. No, she would do that, though.
You think?
The whole thing, her whole play?
I love it.
I think so.
I mean, I don't mean her whole play. I mean, maybe...
What would she not do? Sorry, I'm not clear.
I think what she wouldn't do is...
Really fall in love with him at the end.
Is stay married to him at the end of the movie. And at the end of the movie does seem a bit like an anticlimax. We're like, whoa, after all this shook out, we're both independently wealthy. And by the way,
she's not wealthy.
No.
She's not as wealthy, I guess.
She's the wealthiest person in the world at the end of the movie.
Yeah, that's what happens at the end, is once Rex Rexroth dies and she gets all this money, she's incredibly wealthy.
Which is actually like the craziest, that's like the most Hollywood ending ever. It's like,
that's true.
My book sold. I won my case. Now we're going to be in love and rich. Hollywood. Hollywood.
That was Hollywood, but that's why I think it would happen, because by then they don't need money anymore.
No,
but they do kind of like, I think they like the intensity and the fight that they bring out in each other. I could see why that would be amusing to them. They're gonna get divorced in 2 years, but they're into it right now.
Okay, I like that. As long as you acknowledge this is not a marriage that's going to last.
No, but I mean, listen, it could, but they'll cheat on each other, you know. But like,
right.
It's just all. I think for them, their relationship is also about like the game that the other brings out in them.
And I like that. I actually like that reading of the movie more. Is this is just one more step in a game that's just going to keep on going, and that's their relationship.
This is not
just,
like a happily ever after.
They
this
make a divorce
like
and then get remarried again because they just can't stay away from each other.
Right. It's like super toxic, but they like can't stay apart. Yeah.
Tom and Jerry, spy versus spy.
Spy versus spy, exactly.
Yeah, so it made sense to me. I didn't have major complaints about plot like I usually do, because it was just like silly and whatever it's supposed to be this way. But
it is silly, and I guess the fact that these characters are so wealthy, I felt like it had less stakes than the average Coen Brothers movie.
Oh my god, but that's what romantic comedies, they have like such low stakes. They have such low stakes, like nobody's gonna die, nobody's gonna whatever.
And
about the visual style, when you're doing a comedy, if you make a visual style too stark, it can throw, I think, bigger monkey wrenches into things than you plan for.
Usually, but the Coen Brothers are so good at it when they do have the Big Lebowski or Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and a very defined visual style for most of their comedies.
But I would say, but it's tough to say like Big Lebowski is totally a comedy, because it's not. I would say there are many more moments in Big Lebowski that are played for something larger than straight laughs and straight comedy. Whereas this movie, like all the dream sequences, and there's a lot more murder in that movie, and
I was so glad there was less murder, because in the beginning when they're opening up with all that violence, I was like, come on, can't I just like catch a break? Because I don't love violence in movies.
Oh yeah, what did you think about that opening scene?
I was waiting for somebody to get really hurt and die, which I hate, because I don't like violence in movies. So Coen Brothers movies are like specifically interesting for me to be watching, but. Yeah, I was glad they like really toned down the physical violence.
Yeah, he just got stabbed in the butt with his Lifetime Achievement Award.
Oh, so funny. It was so funny. I mean,
And perfect casting on the pool guy.
Yeah.
The douchey blonde pool guy.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, man, yeah.
Yeah.
That was good.
And it really was, even just that was like, okay, we're going to have our actors, and we're going to basically tell our actors to just totally cut loose. Like,
yeah.
These actors were not too worried about overdoing it in these scenes.
Right.
Every performance was just so big.
Right.
Although I thought George Clooney and his buddy, I thought his buddy was so good in this, even though he was, you know, you didn't like the guy. I just thought he was so good.
Yeah. It might have been me personally. I'll acknowledge that for me, that guy kind of got on my nerves at times and was just, you know, your mileage may vary on that. I did like him crying at weddings. I thought that was funny.
Oh my god, how fantastic was that priest?
Oh yeah.
The mullet priest with the guitar playing Simon and Garfunkel. Oh my god.
Was I asleep for that part?
No, when she got married to Billy Bob. And just before he ate the prenup.
And when Billy
Bob ate. Okay.
Oh,
and when Billy Bob ate the prenup, holy shit, was that funny.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, but one more big unrealistic law note. Every time they introduce the Massey prenup and then rip it up and decide that means the prenup doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, it's not real.
Even in 2003, they had digital copies, right?
Yeah, but you had to make a digital copy. So no, if they ripped it up before, like she ripped it up within,
it doesn't
like
matter. They have
hours.
Several copies of a right. group. There's no such thing that you have a prenup where there's only one copy of it.
Although so. I've been on places where people have taken a release. Someone was stupid enough to wave a sign, the actual copy of a signed release in front of the actor.
Yeah,
and the actor grabbed it and walked out. And that was
that. But that just here that would not be happening.
Like, although if you did like you had a prenup on you because you wrote it and you got married at Vegas Chapel, and then you went home and you ripped it up like 2 hours after you got married at the Vegas Chapel, that could actually happen.
Yeah, that could. But I think hers with Billy Bob, like when you like go to a lawyer's office, you have like multiple copies of stuff, and that itself wouldn't like get rid of it.
I believe they did have mimeograph technology.
Yes. I'm sure they had some paralegal working on it somewhere. There's a copy of it somewhere. That's my point.
Yeah, agree.
not in Catherine Zeta-Jones. Not in George Clooney Zeta-Jones case because there was nobody there. It was at the spur of the moment.
Oh yeah, he did. Yeah, okay. He did just have a Massey prenup in his pocket, and then she ripped it up. And Richard Jenkins had a great look as she did that. He was like, my God, Marilyn, you're exposed.
Yeah, I love that. Exposed.
Another Coen Brothers touch is the repeated dialogue.
Yeah.
That line repeating, and also obviously, I'm gonna nail his ass.
I'm gonna nail his ass.
Cedric the Entertainer was really funny in it.
Cedric the Entertainer was great. It made me realize how much I miss Cedric the Entertainer.
He's great. Really good. Yeah. He's always good.
And then it made me think about what's his last name, which I should look it up because I love that he just goes by Cedric.
It's Entertainer.
It's not really.
His middle name is The.
Shut up. I'm not that gullible.
His last name is The Entertainer.
Yeah. All right, guys.
Attila the Hun, Jack the Ripper, they all share the same middle name, right?
Right, yeah. That's so weird.
Jeffrey the Dahmer.
Yes, Jeffrey the Dahmer. Dom and Dahmer.
Dom and Dahmer.
Serial
killer. Pat Pence!
Okay, order. There's no patents pending.
Okay.
It's Cedric Antonio Kyles, in case you're wondering.
Interesting. And just talking about the dialogue here, and again, you guys could feel free to disagree with me. I know I'm the Coen Brothers guy, but I feel like I liked this movie less than either of you guys. I don't know. They nail the ass thing was funny the first couple of times, but they just kept bringing it back.
I didn't feel like I didn't feel like that was my favorite or funny part at all. I don't watch a lot of Coen Brothers movies. I watch them, but they don't always make me feel good inside.
Yeah.
Like they're always great movies, but they don't always make me feel good. So they're not things I generally cycle back to a lot. But so that's why seeing this, I was like, man, these guys are so good at what they do. Even if this is mediocre work for them, it's still so much better. I mean, just watch your average comedy in the theater.
And if you revise your expectations, this is way better than the average romantic comedy.
America laugh.
Yes.
Not in terms of its ability to make America laugh.
Well, what makes America laugh, though?
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Yeah. Wait, can I make a comment about that since we're talking about this issue?
Please.
So I've been watching the Coen Brothers movies, like, you know, every week, and I've been really critical, and I think I've still been less critical today than I have been of other films.
Yeah, you kind of like this one.
Yeah, I thought it was entertaining, so I was good with it. But like, I had a conversation with a coworker recently who just talked about the fact that like movies can just like take people out of their miserable like whatever existence.
Sure,
escapism. Yeah, and he talked about the escapism, and like ever since he said it, just the way he phrased it, I didn't say it very well just now myself, but I've been a little bit less like harsh and judgmental about movies because I'm just kind of like, yeah, even if it's like a stupid rom-com, it just kind of helps people like chill out and enjoy, even though I still think it's stupid, but now I'm a little less judgmental of that, so now I have a much more like chill view on movies and what they do.
I agree 10,000%.
Yeah,
and I would say that in a lot of ways this movie doesn't feel very responsible, doesn't feel like a very responsible use of other people's money. and that's the way I really look at movies these days, because you know, people who complain about art in movies, I'm like, you know what? If you want to do art, don't do art that takes on the low end $10 million to make. Because that's right. That's obnoxious.
But it's, I still conceited. Love art.
Listen, no. I'm saying, that's what I'm saying. Like, go do painting, go do whatever. But once you need to start spending $10 million of other people's money, you better make something that people want, or you better have such a fantastic track record. I mean, this is my opinion. So, by the way, you can make movies for art, and you can go be an artist. You can write, you can paint, you can do whatever. But movies is tough because it takes so many other people's resources.
You just don't like them. You just don't like making a movie with a big budget for art.
Purely for art's sake.
So like
that is
so like a Noah.
I mean, listen, it doesn't feel very responsible to me.
Right.
You know, but it worked. Right. And Darren Aronofsky is one of those few people who's good enough. But you know, when you're like, oh, I should be able to make whatever movie I want for $100 million, you're like, what are you retarded? What are you stupid?
Right.
There are people who can't eat. There are people who can't eat, and you want $100 million for your vision? No.
Right.
If your vision,
well, I think you'd be, if you're more self-funded than that, then sure.
Yeah,
you can
of
make
course.
Your art. Yeah, of and course. I totally hear what you're saying,
but
too.
Very few people who are totally self-funded complain about the studio system breathing down their neck.
Yeah. I generally agree that if you're going to make a movie for like a real budget that you're expecting like a lot of people to come and see, you should. It's great that you want to make art, but you should try to make art that also appeals to people.
I mean, that's what you're doing. You're making it's almost at that price point, it's commerce first. And I hate to say it, you have to bring artistry and vision and voice to commerce.
Yeah, I get that, but you know what? I will say this too. So even though now I'm a little bit more relaxed about just like movies being chill and they don't have to have the most intense artistic or meaning or depth or anything, but myself, I still prefer that kind of thing, and I kind of prefer things that like are just like kind of make people think more or make people better or like somehow increase some level of something in humanity.
Oh, and by the way, but people can do both. I mean, you can do both.
Right. But yes. So I mean, like, it would be nice though if. Because right now the studio system is just to entertain and make money. And like what's entertaining is like, I don't know, like reality TV is entertaining. I don't love reality TV, but reality TV is like the big thing. And it would be nice though if there was a way to make art, like make people better. And also studios would think that that's profitable and worth it for them to do. We're not at that point culturally, but like I feel like in other countries, like in Europe and stuff, there's like, there's not this like studio system that's like put stuff out, make money. So that's just to say that I think we could get to that, but we're not there. So,
well, I think it'll always be a mix of both. And I do think that making a movie that people want to see and that people will pay for, if all it is fluff that makes them feel good, you can't like to be angry. They spent so much money making Terminator 2 is like, I remember when it came out, they're like, someone spent $100 million on this movie. I was like, dude, do you complain when someone spends $100 million on a skyscraper? Because it's the same thing. It's commerce. Like, if the plan is to make your money back, then it's commerce. Either it's good commerce or bad commerce. By the way, I think you're right. And the nice thing
it's
is...
cultural issue.
The nice thing is that at no point, I don't think ever in any point in history, has more content of varying types been made any given second.
Oh, not even close.
And if you want to see movies that are... I mean, there's so many movies coming out, they may not get wide release, you may not hear about them, but if you go out and look, you can find pretty much anything you want to a degree.
You know, you don't have to make a movie that also appeals to like the Chinese audience and is going to make like worldwide box office, but you should make a movie that's going to appeal to a reasonably large audience.
Or the other thing is like if you have such a good track record and you're like, listen, I can make money doing what I do, therefore instead of overthinking it, I'm just going to keep doing what I do. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But at least you gave it. At least there was a bankable business plan and model in mind. You know.
You know, Oh Brother.
I'm nodding. I realize.
We just watched Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which I feel like works as a piece of art and as escapism. That's actually just a really fun movie to watch.
Yeah.
This, I'm not sure if it works as well on either level, frankly.
It's not a piece of art, but I did find it entertaining.
I would have trouble. So that's that. I would have trouble using this as escapism. This wouldn't take me away.
Unless you're a divorce lawyer. I don't know. Even then, it's probably not.
Well, I am a lawyer, and this took me away.
But, okay, that's good.
No, but it was just light. It was fine. Because I liked certain elements of the performances enough that I was like, that was fun.
I realized, talking to you about this yesterday, I realized that not a single Coen Brothers movie passes the Bechdel test.
Right, yeah. Because
Was that how you pronounce it?
I think so.
Bechdel?
I think so.
I was saying Bechdel, but
I don't know. We saw a different movie last night. We were at a screening, and
and like after the Q&A, like one of the actresses was talking about that, and I was like, yeah, Coen Brothers movies. Like, no.
The one that comes close, I was really thinking back, thinking of every movie, the one that comes closest is actually Raising Arizona. Where Ed and Frances McDormand have a conversation about the baby. But even that, you're having a conversation about a baby boy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
true. So it doesn't pass the test.
I call Burn After Reading a great social commentary, and I would say a good piece of parody that
Spoiler alert, don't say what it's about.
That also did well. It did quite well.
That was, one of their most financially successful movies.
I would say No Country for Old Men is not a traditional thriller. Did well. True Grit, I was surprised at how well it did.
It helped that No Country for Old Men got the big box office bump. Yeah.
You mean the Oscar bump?
Sorry, the Oscar bump.
Yeah, totally. Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
But their last few movies have actually... I think True Grit was by far their most successful movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they've been doing well. I mean, they do hundreds,
And they don't have ridiculous budgets either. They don't spend a ton of money. All. Yeah.
And Inside Llewyn Davis was, that was a very artsy art film, I think. Yes. But I also think it cost nothing, too.
Exactly. Cost nothing and not an inaccessible movie either.
I mean, my favorite like, big box office art would probably be, My favorite example of like balls out to the wall, like personal vision, and that is like Inception. Like the guy made a movie about his vision of making movies. Like it was about the movie making process, but it also was this monster, monster thing. And that's the high end of like personal vision and box office success.
It's impressive and it's really hard to pull that off.
Yeah.
I think more often when filmmakers try something like Inception, you end up with a ridiculous flop. It's very impressive that he was able to do that.
Yeah. And it was like this is what the filmmaker, it was very much his personal
I'll have
vision.
To watch it.
You should see Inception.
I know, I haven't seen it.
You should see Inception.
It's great.
It is actually really good. It's easy to nitpick to death. Also, it's ridiculous, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, but it's like it's an allegory. It's an allegory about creativity, an allegory about storytelling.
No question.
But what was I gonna say? But can we just say it? Like, holy shit! I thought George Clooney was hilarious in this, and I thought Billy Bob Thornton was hilarious in this. Like, it was hilarious,
and especially so different than what we just saw in Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah, it's, oh, that made me so happy.
Billy Bob Thornton is great. We're actually going to watch Bad Santa for this podcast. Too,
oh wow!
Very shortly, and that's that's going to be another signature great Billy Bob Thornton.
Does he have something to do with that? Is Coen Brothers have
the
something
Coen brother?
To do with
it? We'll get into it. But the Coen Brothers ghost wrote it, according to most accounts.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we'll get into that on a very short, I think maybe even the very next episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
Woohoo.
Anyways, we are just about out of time with this segment, but any final thoughts on Intolerable Cruelty from either of you guys?
I liked it.
I mean, listen, if you're into movies, you should see it because it's a really, for what it is, it's incredibly well made. You know, in terms of like what the baseline is out there, it's very well made and has amazing performances and has amazing visual comedy in it. Maybe not the whole thing, but at times it just really goes. It's worth it just for that banter in the courtroom before me. This is classic modern Marx Brothers, you know?
It very classically farce dialogue. Although that scene, to me, that scene went on too long.
Okay,
too much.
Actually,
of that.
I agree with you. Yeah, I was like, "Shut up! You're before this judge. Shut up!"
But I feel like when you get one of those runs going, when you have it, you're just like, "I need to go as long as possible because the logic is still working. We still got the logic going, and we haven't repeated ourselves. It's fantastic."
And another pet peeve, and maybe this movie just hits a lot of personal pet peeves for me. Another pet peeve is people quoting poetry to each other as an example of witty repartee. Which is something I don't think people actually do a whole lot in real life.
Not really.
No, yeah.
It's just kind of a screenwriter invention of, okay, I'll Google some poetry, and this means these guys are sophisticated and having sophisticated banter with each other.
Yeah.
I would not recommend this movie in a non-academic context.
Okay.
Like, I would say, like, if you are a screenwriter, if you like making comedies or you like studying comedies, see this movie. Like, absolutely. If you like the Coen Brothers, see this movie.
Sure. If you're a Coen Brothers completist, see this movie.
I knew you were gonna say that.
If you're a
completist?
Yes. If you're looking for
That's a good word.
If you're looking for a better than average and more cynical than average romantic comedy, I'd say see this. If you're looking for a great movie, you should lower your expectations slightly.
I'm not even recommending it, to be honest. I just enjoyed it that night. And I still stand by it.
Yeah.
So I probably wouldn't recommend it to like just an average person. Right. And by average person, I don't mean average. I mean like somebody who isn't like, oh, I've been writing comedy for 20 years, so I probably, not maybe successfully, right. but I've been right. trying to write comedy for 20 years, so it's very interesting to see this.
Yeah.
But is it, would I tell somebody who, say, is like a nuclear physicist and an actually smart person who doesn't really give a shit about entertainment to see it, I'd be like, I totally.
Yeah, probably not. But if it's on TV and you happen to stop on it, it's not something you should be at least.
I would say if it was a choice between this and Transformers, the first Transformers, I would probably stop on the first Transformers because that is something I can watch 20 minutes at a time if I flip to it.
Okay, we're not even going to touch Transformers. Yeah. We don't have the time.
We do not.
It's got what's his face in it.
Shia LaBeouf.
No,
it has Totoro. It does have John Turturro.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
But it's like John Turturro's worst performance by far. It's not a reason to see
him.
It.
But anyways,
God, we got one more segment to do.
All right, sorry.
It's a little segment called Raising Arquizona. Which is when we do a 10-question quiz loosely inspired by the movie, and the topic of today's quiz is divorce.
Ew. Wait, can I just say something? I do something called Pop Quiznos, where people have to answer trivia while eating a sandwich, and I think that's more fun.
We don't have any sandwiches.
I'm sorry. That wasn't even more fun to say.
Sorry. No, we don't have any sandwiches here. You can drink energy drinks if you want. All this to power your brain up. But we have 10 facts about divorce, and we have multiple choice questions, and I'll read them out. And it's when you think you know the answer, just say it.
So me versus the lawyer.
Yes.
That's right.
But these aren't law facts. They're divorce facts.
Okay.
Facts about divorce. Here we go. Question number one. In America, what percentage of first marriages end in divorce? 40%, 50%, or 60%?
Seems rigged because everybody always tells you it's 50%.
No, it's the first marriages are not 50%. It's 50% of all marriages, but that includes second and third marriages who are a self-selecting group to be more inclined toward divorce.
I'm going
to
say 40.
It's 40. It's under. I actually thought it was lower than that. I thought it was in the 30s, but I'll go with the low percentage.
You guys are both right. It's 40%.
There it is. It would have to be. If 50% of all marriages end in divorce and that includes second and third marriages, then your first marriage cannot be 50%.
The math adds up.
Yeah, the math does add up. It's true. There is a higher rate of divorce for second marriages, but that overall number has gone down. It peaked in the 80s. In the 80s, 50% of first marriages ended in divorce.
Really? So love isn't dead.
No.
Case love dismissed.
Love is on the rise.
Yeah.
Here in America.
And we...
All right.
With help from HuffPost lists and TED Talks.
Yes.
Love is alive.
Thank God. Thank God we have TED Talks to keep the spark going.
And GIF and animated GIF lists.
Question number two. You are 75% more likely to get divorced if which of these things is true about you?
Ew.
A, you have a commute longer than 45 minutes. B, you're a smoker. C, your parents are divorced.
Now, is this you have a 75% chance of divorce, or you're 75% more likely?
A 75% more likely than the average person to get divorced.
I'm gonna go with A.
They said the commute and the parents, but I'll go with the lawyer. Commute.
You're both saying commute?
Yeah.
You're both wrong. The answer is if you're a smoker, you're 75% more likely to get divorced.
That's so funny.
I would have said differently. In fact, I did.
Interesting.
You did.
Okay.
I don't know why. I don't know. I have no idea
Smokers are selfish.
Maybe it's because they don't care about their own bodies.
Yeah.
So why should anybody else love them if they don't love themselves?
I think that's it.
I don't know. Are you a smoker?
No, I'm not.
Okay, good. Thank God. None of us are smokers here. Except you smoke cigars sometimes.
And I've never really seriously dated a smoker either.
What?
I've never seriously dated a smoker either.
Okay.
I'm Russian, so I feel like I get a pass to just like occasionally have a cigarette. I've never bought my own cigarettes, but it'll happen.
You could drink nothing but vodka and you'll be fine.
That is true. Yeah, I know. So sometimes, I mean, I've had cigarettes here or there and like it horrifies my mom and upsets her, but you know, so it's fine. But I'm not a smoker.
Okay.
So I'm just saying.
Just a occasional cigarette smoker, but not a smoker per se.
Okay. Not at all.
Good. Good.
No, I'm glad. No addiction.
I'm glad.
No problem.
Are you divorced?
No.
See? It's all a lie.
I've never been married though. I don't have a chance to be divorced.
If you were married, would you treat men like a safari that you go in and you're stalking your prey?
Absolutely.
I thought so. I thought that resonated with you.
I wrote that line down though.
Yeah.
But I will note that people don't go on safaris because they hate animals.
It's a good line.
Right.
It's a good line.
I like that one.
That is a good line.
Mm-hmm.
Question number three. The oldest man and woman ever to get divorced were 99 and 96 respectively. when they split in 2011, what was the reason given for their split? A, he discovered she cheated on him in the 40s. B, he wanted to sail around the world and she didn't. C, he wanted an open marriage and she didn't.
I'm just going to go C because that's funny.
Yeah. I would say C also, but I just want to mix it up since we keep answering the same thing. I guess I'm going to go with A. I don't know.
Sailing around the world is fun, though.
Jackie is right.
Haha.
Yeah, he found old love letters from the 1940s of an old beau.
Fantastic.
And decided, you know what? I just can't keep it going. I've been with a liar all these decades.
I love that.
Question number four. Which of these celebrities had the shortest marriage?
Who?
Drew Barrymore, Kim Kardashian, or Britney Spears?
Britney Spears.
Spears, yeah.
You guys are both right. You guys know your pop culture trivia.
That was like the fastest answer ever on this entire podcast.
That is right. If you guys forgot out there, Britney and her childhood friend Jason Alexander were married for less than 55 hours.
Yeah, never forget. That was funny.
Question number five. In the ancient Middle Eastern state of Chaldea, if a man wanted to divorce his wife, he merely had to say, "Thou art not my wife," and it was done. If a woman ever said, "Thou art not my husband," to her husband, what happened to her? A, she was given to the man's brother or nearest male relative. B, she was expelled from the village. C, she was immediately drowned.
I was going to say stoned to death.
Yeah, I feel like there's definitely like, I'm going to go with the brother. I'll say different. You say dead, I'll say brother.
We don't have to say different ones, but I was going to say B.
You're saying expelled from the village?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with then if you're not going with that, I'm going with drowned because they, you know, people were not very nice. Sure. Especially toward women back then.
They sure were not, and the lady sure was drowned.
Wow.
Like, immediately.
Wow. Jesus.
People. Yeah.
Where's my I hate people?
No, that's not.
That was really good, though.
But you are shocked.
Yeah. I hate people. There you go. Ugh, I hate movies. I hate people.
You hate movies and people.
That's right.
Question number six. One-third of... you guys are tied now.
Yeah.
Because you guys both got one question right. All right.
Two. Well, because we tied in the beginning.
Right. Yeah, because you tied in the beginning. Question number six. One-third of all divorce filings in 2011 contained which of these words? A.
One-third of all divorce filings?
In 2011 contained which of these words in the filing? A. Texting. B. Facebook. C. Pornography.
Facebook.
You guys are right.
Yeah, Facebook. We're pretty good at
this. They say that's like definitely like... That's like the precursor to cheating.
Yeah. Social networking is like a rapidly growing factor in divorces. Yeah. People just finding each other, messaging each other. It seems safe at first, but then it leads to illicit behavior,
or at least emotional affairs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is even worse, right?
Yeah. Not really.
It could be
not really
bad though.
It can be
okay. Ugly.
No, I didn't say it's good.
Yeah,
I just said, you know, you've.
But sometimes it's just sex, right? So it's kind of hard to say.
Right. If it was sex, but you weren't sharing feelings. Feelings!
But only one of those
We're
things
so
is
We're so pressed
like,
for time, but I just, for 2 seconds, want to get into this one issue, because on Sex in the City, in the movie, I don't want to spoil it for you, because we might do the Sex in the City, whatever. Wait, should I just not spoil it?
No, anyway, say it.
Oh, because Josh hasn't seen, you haven't seen Sex in the City.
I've never seen Sex in the City.
So you were going to go, wow.
Yeah, I think we're going to
Well, let's just say there's a character who cheated on another character, and when that happened, it was also because there was like this big drought of sex and like all this like weird other stuff that happened, and in the end, they reconciled, and you were actually okay with it, because you were like, no, I get it. Like, it was just sex. It wasn't like this big, huge emotional affair. So I just wanted to know that sometimes... It can hurt even more when it's an emotional affair.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Besides, just like, you just did it. You just had like an animal sex situation. That's one thing. So anyway, just saying, sometimes it is worse.
Oh, yeah.
I would be more hurt by the emotional cheating.
Me too.
Yeah.
Well, but I would say like,
even though the sex thing is really big, I'm just saying, like,
it's
if you're
bad.
Like
it's
really
bad.
Into this person and in love with them or whatever, ugh, no. So anyway.
You told them and you didn't tell me?
Kind of. Yeah.
Okay. Question number seven.
You like their photo, but you didn't like my photo.
You always retweet him, and you never retweet me.
Yeah.
You just favorite me, but
I looked on
artsy.
Graph Search, and I can see all the photos and comments you've liked. Graph Search.
All right, question number seven. Which of these is not a real story about divorce? Two of these are real. One of them is fake. Which one is fake? A. When a former husband and wife in Brooklyn both refused to move out of their home, a judge ordered them to build a wall through the middle of their house, each of them taking half of the house.
That's real.
Yeah,
B,
I think that's real too.
A Florida couple got divorced after the wife heard their pet parrot repeating another woman's name, a woman the husband was sleeping with. C, when Karen Finnegan attempted to divorce her husband, she refused on the grounds that he died 3 years earlier after a heart attack, invalidating the phrase, "till death do you part."
All right, I'm gonna go with the
parrot.
Parrot, yeah, the parrot. Even though that seems totally plausible, I'm gonna say the parrot is not real.
You guys are good at this one. The parrot is not real.
Boom.
And yeah, that guy who died, his story did not hold up in court.
Of course,
shockingly.
Not. But it sounds like something stupid that somebody would say, which I love. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I was legally dead for a while, and when that happened, that invalidated the marriage. Question number 8. It's commonly believed worldwide that the U.S. has the highest rate of divorce, but they are only 6th on the worldwide list. Huh. What country actually has the highest rate of divorce? A. Russia. B. Brazil. C. The Cayman Islands.
Oh, Cayman Islands. Gotta be.
You saying Cayman Islands, Jackie?
Cayman Islands is its own country?
It sure is.
So ignorant. Why am I so ignorant? Cayman Islands. Because
that's where you go for, like, shady, bendable contracts.
Any sort of, like, shady deals.
But are people getting married in the Cayman Islands? Are we talking?
I bet there's a lot of rich people. Rich people, like, really rich people. Rich, shady people have a lot of divorces. Yeah, and I bet there are people who are, like, citizens.
It sounds so right, but I'm going to go with Brazil.
You guys are both wrong. It's Russia.
What? Russia. I hate when I get Russian answers wrong.
Russia is number one, but Cayman Islands is ahead of the U.S. It was 5th on the list.
Interesting.
And Brazil is actually one of the lowest rates. Sri Lanka, Brazil, and Italy.
Well, Brazil's a Catholic country, right?
Yeah, they're Catholic countries, so they have some of the lowest rates of divorce.
On my part.
Yeah.
And I think it's also like the freer you are about sex, the less your divorce rates are. It's like France. Is France higher than America or lower than America?
I want to say it's lower.
Yeah, because they're just like, everyone like, has whatever, affair. Just, they're like, mistress. if you're upset, just have an affair.
Yeah. It's all good.
Man, you guys are tied and we have 2 questions left. Woo! This is coming down to the wire.
Yeah, it's exciting.
The wire.
Yeah, it's a great show. Question number 9.
Or The Wire by Haim, but yeah.
Also, it's a great song.
Yeah.
On average, how long do Americans wait to remarry after they get divorced? 2 years, 3 years, 5 years?
2 years.
3 years.
Jake, it's a point.
Oh! No!
And
no,
Russia.
No,
and
no.
Russia.
Okay. On average, women wait 3.1 years and men wait 3.3 years.
God damn it.
Men wait a little bit longer. They're enjoying their bachelorhood just that little bit more, apparently.
They always get sucked in, though. Yeah.
Okay. Man. Well, Jackie, you can still tie.
How dare you?
Yeah, we need to add that to the board. We definitely do.
Yeah.
Ugh. What profession has the highest rate of divorce? A, dancers and choreographers. B, nurses. C, bartenders. And I'll just let you know, all 3 of those are in the top 10, but which one...
Is cops in the top 10?
I don't know if cops are in the top 10.
Lawyers in the top 10?
I don't know.
TV shows would say cops are in the top 10.
Because it's hard to be married to a
so
cop.
So I'm going with
cause
either...
Because they're married to the job.
I'm going... it's dancers or bartenders. Dancers, choreographers, and bartenders. It's one of the two.
Yeah, I agree with you. Saying dancers.
Bartenders.
Jackie's right.
Yes! Oh! I knew it! I knew we were going to tie. I almost broke this mic.
Fuck,
yes!
I didn't have a tiebreaker question,
though. Where's another question, Josh?
Okay, wait. I actually have one.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I just broke that. No, I didn't.
Quinky quonk this. Quinky quonk this or quinky quonk that.
No, it's
tight. Maybe not.
Yeah, it was this thing.
Okay. One of these 3 answers are not in the bottom 10 for professions for divorces. I'll read 3 professions. Which of them is not in the bottom 10?
Okay.
Teachers, nuclear engineers, podiatrists.
Podiatrists.
Nuclear engineers are not. They seem stable.
Wait, not, but that's the bottom 10 is the stable part.
Yeah, the bottom 10 are the stable ones.
Oh, they're not in the dot. Oh,
These are the bottom 10.
Okay, read them again.
Teachers, nuclear engineers, podiatrists. Which one is not in the bottom 10 for professions that...
Podiatrists, because they make a lot of money and probably second marriages.
That's what I said, though.
Yeah.
So we can't...
Guys, you guys, say something different.
No, we're not going to. Were we right?
No, but you're both wrong.
What the fuck? Well, we could just tie a game.
Ah, fine. You guys are tied.
What was it?
Teachers. Teachers are not at the bottom 10. Both nuclear engineers and podiatrists are also clergy, by the way. Which makes sense, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyways, fine. You guys are tied.
Yeah, that was our first tie because we tied on a tiebreaker.
You tied on a tiebreaker.
That was a fun one.
You guys are great, and Josh, you're so good at radio. You're such a radio professional.
Oh, right? Thank you.
I met him in a non-radio setting.
Right.
Yeah. And to get to see him do his radio thing.
See me in my element.
Really
in my element.
Yeah.
Well, we okay. Yeah, we got.
And I'm not talking about a mid-size Honda SUV.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about like Xenon. All right, real quickly, Jake. If people want to find out funny things you've written or stuff you can do online or want to follow you on social media, anything like that, where can they find you?
Okay, so I've got a website, www.jacobfleischer.com, jacobfleischer.com, F-L-E-I-S-H-E-R, no C,
sweet,
not related to Ari, and I'm at jayfly, J-A-Y-F-L-Y, Twitter, jayfly, and what else? That's my website, jacobfleischer.com.
Yeah.
And Twitter, jayfly. There you
go. Check out all that stuff.
Cool.
Lots of cool links.
Yeah.
Jackie, where can people find you?
Twitter, M-A-C-Q-U-E-L-I-N-E.
Did you tweet anything funny?
Probably. Just check it out, people. I'm hilarious.
She is.
New
just
vibes funny. Over here.
I'm following you. The second I get home and I can search better.
Awesome.
And you can follow me on you can follow me on Twitter at Radio TFB. You can find me online at joshrichmond.net. You can find other episodes of this podcast online at accepthemystery.net. Don't forget to review us on iTunes and subscribe on iTunes and just do all sorts of Accept the Mystery related stuff on iTunes.
Yeah.
Leave us
get
a review.
Into it.
Yeah. Just go crazy. Just go nuts. Yeah.
Get
balls
wild,
out.
Yeah.
Go balls out on it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just get in there and retweet my whole catalog.
That's yeah, funny. Yeah. Nobody, your friends
just
won't mind.
Just retweet my back catalog.
Blow up every JFly tweet.
There it is.
Okay. We got to wrap up. Jake. I said Jakey.
I said Jakey.
I said Jakey.
Jakey. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for coming.
Guys, thank you so much. This was so cool. It's my first podcast ever.
I'm glad we broke your podcast too.
Pop. That was my podcast hymen.
Awesome.
Oh, I could have said cherry. It would have been better. That was gross when I said hymen.
That's just the soundboard.
That's the soundboard. All right, guys.
Do you have a button that says not asked back? Not asked back.
Case dismissed. Oh, maybe.
Oh, wait. And I do have this.
Swipe left.
You have been swiped left. No, not really.
Ooh, swipe
left. Oh, it's still funny, guys. Thank you so much.
All right, that's it, guys. Until next time, everybody, peace and love.
Peace and love.
Hooray!